As you know, the Institute regularly sponsors independent policy forum events essentially on a monthly basis. And events include lectures and seminars and debates and so forth, featuring outstanding scholars, policy experts, and authors of important new books. Our program tonight is, as most of you know, is entitled Friedrich Hayek and the Future of Liberty. And we have two distinguished speakers with us. The first being Alan Ebenstein, who is the author of this very important biography of Hayek, which I hope everyone will pick up a copy. It's a fascinating book. For those of you who know about Hayek, you'll learn a great deal more, I guarantee you. Those of you who don't know much about it, you'll find it's a fascinating story of a man and the ideas of liberty. Our second speaker is Chuck Baird, a good friend. And Chuck is a professor of economics at California State University at Hayward. He's also director of the Smith Center, and we're quite pleased that the Smith Center is co-sponsoring tonight's program, as you can see from the banner. Before I move further, I wanted to mention that the Smith Center also sponsors events at Cal State Hayward primarily. The next event is going to be on May 30th with the syndicated columnist Robert Novak. Many of you may know of him from being a host of a number of programs on CNN. Chuck has brought tickets. Any of you who would like to buy tickets are welcome to do so, and I certainly encourage you to attend. I think it should be an excellent event.
The tickets are only $10.
Students are $3.
Wow. Students are $3.
I want to also thank Robert Mondavi Winery, who donated the wine that we enjoyed this evening. As well as the customer company, which has kindly also been a sponsor of our series. For those of you who may be new to the Institute, hopefully you picked up a packet when you registered. You'll find information in the packet about our program of public policy research and publication. We produce many books. This is our quarterly journal called the Independent Review. And you'll find information about many other projects of the Institute. In the packet, you'll find a flyer, which is about tonight's program. And on the bottom of the front of the flyer, you'll find also information about two of the upcoming events. I also wanted to point out that you'll find information about our program, plus an extensive archive of research studies and other publications on our website at independent.org, as well as up-to-date information on events and other activities. One thing I wanted to point out is the event that we held here in March with John McWhorter, who is from the University of California, Berkeley. He spoke on the topic, Losing the Race, based on his new book, Black Progress, Freedom, Independence. The program is going to be rebroadcast on C-SPAN 2 this Saturday evening at 6:45 p.m. The upcoming events, which are on this flyer I mentioned that we're going to be holding, the next one is on July 5th. The subject of that program is Why Are the Public Schools Failing and What Can Be Done? The speakers will include John Merrifield, who is professor of economics at the University of Texas at San Antonio, and author of the new book, The School Choice Wars, and Richard Vedder, who's a senior fellow here and also professor of economics at Ohio University. And he's authored a new monograph of ours called Can Teachers Own Their Own Schools? On August 14th, we'll also be hosting Larry Elder, who many of you know is a very popular talk show host in Los Angeles at KABC, and also is host of a program, I believe it's called Moral Court on Warner Brothers Television. And this fall, probably in September, we don't have it nailed down yet, but probably in September we'll be hosting Thomas Zars, will be speaking on his new book called Pharmacracy, of which there's an excerpt in this new issue of the Independent Review. In your packet, one last thing I wanted to point out is each summer we host a series of summer seminars for high school and undergraduate college students called the Summer Seminars in Political Economy, and this year we'll be holding them once again. They're 1 week programs, Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 12:30. They're conducted by the economist Joseph Furick from Golden Gate University and the University of San Francisco. This year, the program will be co-sponsored by Holy Names College here in Oakland. And for those students who are from out of town, we have accommodations at Holy Names at an incredible bargain. Also, Holy Names is offering a one-hour college course credit in economics for those students who complete the program. So I think that anyone who's interested in having students receive really, I think, a life-changing experience of understanding the world they live in, this is a program that we hope that you will have them participate in.
What dates are those?
The exact dates are July 7 to 13 and August 13 to 17. This evening, we're here to discuss the life and ideas of the eminent economist and political philosopher Friedrich A. Hayek. For myself, I hold a special reverence for Hayek and his work. In my case, years ago when I was a young man in the Air Force in Louisiana, I managed to first stumble across Hayek's work. In my instance, in order to overcome what I thought was a grinding boredom and incompetence that I found when I was living in the Air Force, I was going through the stacks, the book stacks in the base library one day, and I happened to stumble across a book, and I opened the book up, and there's a chapter in it. The chapter was entitled, Why I Am Not a Conservative. And I thought that was rather provocative, and the book happened to be The Constitution of Liberty by Hayek. Now, this was during the anti-war period of the Vietnam War, and one of the things that struck me about this chapter was how, in some respects, what Hayek was saying in a rather more eloquent way was somewhat reminiscent of what I was seeing in the news almost daily about the anti-war movement and the view of the government. At the same time, it also reminded me of some of the speeches of Barry Goldwater, which at that time was just about 5 or 6 years earlier when he ran for president. So it intrigued me. It seemed like there were two different wings of popular political culture that were sort of discussing something along the lines of what he was saying. So I read the entire book. I then ordered through the base library books, any book that he referenced essentially in that book. And that led me to von Mises and Friedman and many others. Hayek's point in this chapter, in case you're interested, why I'm not a conservative, was that he was indeed not a conservative. He was a liberal. In the true classical sense of the word, he was interested in liberty. And the way he described it, he was a Whig. He was not going to ally himself with any of the parties then. In fact, as many of you may know, his book, The Road to Serfdom, is dedicated to the socialists of all parties. He was, in his view, he was not interested in conserving what government did. He was interested in conserving ideas or advancing understanding of ideas of civil society. And he viewed political institutions as being the primary way to undermine these civil institutions, institutions based on individual choice and action, and the accumulated ideas, traditions, and consensual rules going back to antiquity. And as a result, he was, being from Austria, he was firmly against what Europeans viewed as conservative, which was people who believed in defending, or in some respects were simply apologists, for what was the stagnation, oppression, and outright human misery of pre-industrial societies under the caste and government privilege of feudal monarchies. The thing that also struck me about Hayek and the new and incredibly rich literature that I had just happened to accidentally discover was that it was largely unknown. It was largely unknown to any of the people I knew. And I had already been to a number of colleges, and I just could not find it having much of any sort of impact. And even in those circles in which they talked about free markets, they would talk about free markets on the one hand, on the other hand, they needed something that would be the opposite. So it intrigued me, and in no small way, that fateful day led to the establishment of the Independent Institute. So Hayek has had a profound impact on the very existence of this institution that we're delighted that you're joining with us tonight. Our first speaker tonight is Alan Ebenstein. Alan is the director of research at the Arthur Roop Foundation. He received his PhD in political philosophy from the London School of Economics and Political Science. He's been a fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he has taught at Santa Barbara City College and Antioch University in Santa Barbara. As most of you know, Alan is the author of this book I mentioned, while the acclaimed book, Friedrich Hayek, a biography. In addition to his biography of Hayek, he's also the author of a number of books, including the book Today's Isms, with his late father William Ebenstein and Edwin Fogelman, Introduction to Political Thinkers, also with his late father, Great Political Thinkers, Plato to the Present, collected works of Edwin Cannon, and The Greatest Happiness Principle, An Examination of Utilitarianism. Alan has been a member of the Santa Barbara Board of Education, I should mention also, for 8 years, and has been a former candidate of the California State Assembly. I'm very pleased to introduce Alan to discuss his book.
Thank you very much. It's a great privilege to be able to talk to you on Hayek tonight. I think that of the think tanks and institutes in the United States, that the Independent Institute is as close to Hayek's thought as any. This talk tonight will largely consist of a biographical presentation of Hayek's views, together with thoughts on the relationship between Hayek's views and modern American social conservatism. In addition, we are fortunate to have Professor Chuck Baird as a commenter. Hayek emerged from the milieu of Austrian liberalism during the last decades of the 19th century and first decades of the 20th. Signal among those who most influenced him were Karl Menger, founder of the Austrian School of Economics, and Ludwig von Mises, the key initiator of the socialist calculation debate. Both Menger and Mises were staunch liberals in the 19th, or perhaps Independent Institute, meaning of the term. Hayek's main professor at the University of Vienna, Friedrich von Wieser, was more of a welfare state interventionist. The conditions in Vienna following World War I, when Hayek became a student at the university, were grievous. Inflation was out of control, the economy collapsed, the traditional social order had been ripped asunder. A completely new society was in the making. And for this reason, it's unsurprising that as a young student at the University of Vienna during the late teens and early 20s, that Hayek for a time adopted mildly socialist outlooks. He was experiencing and thought he would participate in the rational construction of a new society. However, he then came into contact with Ludwig von Mises, and his views then changed. Hayek liked to describe his first meeting with Mises rather humorously. He came to Mises in 1921 with a letter of introduction from Wieser, who described him as, quote, a promising economist. Quote, promising economist, Mises asked. I've never seen you at any of my lectures. Mises was a short, burly man given to occasional temperamental outbursts. He possessed a clear intellect, however, and Hayek learned much from him. The work of Mises that most influenced Hayek was Mises' socialism, which made the argument not that socialism would be ethically or morally undesirable, but that it literally does not deliver the goods. Mises' accomplishment was to turn the question of socialism from an ethical to a practical one. Not would socialism be desirable, but how would it work? So effective was Mises' argument that even many socialists admitted its power. Oscar Lange, a prominent Polish socialist, went so far as to say that, quote, a statue of Professor Mises ought to occupy an honorable place in the Great Hall of the Ministry of Socialization of the Socialist State. Quite a statement. In 1931, after 10 years of working for and with Mises, Hayek went to the London School of Economics and Political Science, and it was here that his career blossomed and he gained worldwide renown. Probably the most famous name now associated with the London School of Economics during this period is Harold Laski, and in considerable part, as a result of Laski's influence, the LSE, as it is also known, gained a reputation as a haven for socialist thought. But there was another tradition at the London School of Economics, which can be traced to its first professor of economics there, Edwin Cannon, one of the greatest scholars of Adam Smith, and a classical liberal in his own right. There was much in Cannon's thought that Hayek found congruent with his own, emphasis on the slow, gradual transformation of societies and institutions. And I think this is one of the really core Hayekian ideas, is that institutions and societies are not planned. They cannot be directed in advance. Rather, they have to be allowed to emerge. And this was an idea that was in Cannon's thought, and as well, this process, which Hayek termed spontaneous order, is also a concept that he found in the work of Karl Menger. Hayek's first work at the London School of Economics was as an economist. He was brought to LSE by the then leading English classical liberal Lionel Robbins, who was a student and successor of Edwin Cannon. Robbins was almost exactly the same age as Hayek, and together at the London School during the 1930s, Robbins and Hayek led a seminar that included many of the emerging leading lights in economics of the day. It had no less than four future Nobel laureates in the same seminar. In addition to Hayek, John Hicks, Arthur Lewis, and Ronald Coase, Arthur Selden of England also participated in the seminar. And on the other side, John Kenneth Galbraith was a visiting student in Hayek's seminar for a year. Hayek was brought to the London School primarily as an opponent to John Maynard Keynes, who had just published in 1930 a treatise on money. Hayek wrote a blistering review of Keynes' treatise that was published simultaneously with his arrival in London. Keynes then wrote an even more blistering reply to Hayek's review article. This is what Keynes said, quote, "Dr. Hayek's Prices and Production seems to me to be one of the most frightful muddles I have ever read. It is an extraordinary example of how, starting with a mistake, a remorseless logician can end up in bedlam." So, notwithstanding this rather inauspicious start, personal relations between Keynes and Hayek soon became good, though they never did agree on economics, and indeed seem to have agreed not to discuss it. During World War II, Hayek became fairly close to Keynes when the London School of Economics moved to Cambridge, where Keynes resided, and it's actually the case that during the war, Hayek and Keynes would sometimes take turns at night watching for fires from the top of King's College in Cambridge. So they had a close personal relationship, although they did not agree professionally. Hayek's great accomplishment during the 1930s was to enunciate the idea of the division of knowledge, which many Hayek commentators consider to be his greatest intellectual achievement. This idea of the division of knowledge occurred to Hayek as he was reflecting on the socialist calculation debate in which Mises had been involved 10 to 15 years earlier. "There are many socialists," Mises had written, "who have never come to grips with the problems of economics. They have criticized freely enough the economic structure of free society, but have consistently neglected to apply to the economics of the disputed state the same caustic acumen. They invariably explain how, in the cloud cuckoo lands of their fancy, roast pigeons will in some way fly into the mouths of the comrades, but they admit to show how this miracle is to take place. How would a socialist society practically be organized? It is not enough merely to point to deficiencies under capitalism." Hayek's brilliant insight is that there is a division of knowledge among all of the members of a society. Knowledge does not exist anywhere in a compact, complete whole. Rather, knowledge is fragmented. It exists in the minds of all of the members of a society. And I think this is really a core Hayekian idea. Words like epistemology and methodology are sometimes somewhat esoteric, but I think the idea is that how is it the case that you form a society when everyone's experience is individual? What sort of society is going to be the most effective to accommodate divided knowledge, knowledge that's divided among the minds of all the people in a society? Hayek's idea of the division of knowledge is very simple, but it is an idea that has potentially profound consequences. Hayek thought that the division of knowledge precludes the possibility of classical socialism, of the central management and direction of a nation's economy from one place. The division of knowledge, he thought, requires capitalism, only under a system, whatever its other flaws, in which the reality of divided knowledge is accommodated, is a materially productive society possible, Hayek believed. Hayek described the essay in which he put forward the idea of the division of knowledge, Economics and Knowledge, as the most important of his career. Later in his life, he sometimes said that he had made one discovery. This discovery was of the division of knowledge and its consequences. If knowledge is divided, how is information communicated? Hayek's answer here, too, is brilliant. Hayek believed that the profit and price system, capitalism, is primarily a system that conveys information. Prices and profits are information. Prices reflect the relative supply of and demand for different goods. Mises uses as an excellent example of how a building would be built under a socialist system to demonstrate the importance of prices. What type of wood should be used? Should bricks or concrete or steel be used in construction? What should the relative amounts of labor and capital that go into construction be? Without a price system, none of these questions can be answered in the most cost-effective and rational manner. Capitalism, through utilizing prices and profits, has been literally the only system that can deliver goods in an advanced technological society. And I think that's really the core question, is how is information about the relative amounts of goods and services to be communicated? How do you know whether you should make a building out of wood or out of steel or out of concrete? And it's the price and profit system in capitalism that conveys that information. Prices are dependent on private property. Unless individuals have exclusive control over property and the ability to exchange it on the terms that they see fit, prices are impossible. This is the problem. This was the problem in the Soviet Union and in other command economies during the 20th century. With no private property, there is no price, and without private properties, there cannot be rational economic calculation. Moreover, profits are as essential as prices to a capitalist order. Later in his career, Hayek further explored the concept of order without orderers or spontaneous order. The role of the business person who makes profits is essential to the capitalist order. Who is the best person to be entrusted with resources? In capitalism, this question is ideally answered by the individuals who make the most prices. That is, the individuals who use resources most effectively. Profits and prices convey information. They are essential, Hayek thought, to a free market order. And along these lines, I think it's crucial in evaluating the role of the entrepreneur is that the ability to make prices, ability to make profits, is not necessarily something that people can tell you how they did it. All you know is that somehow they're able to conduct effective enterprises and conduct effective businesses. And that's one of the great strengths of capitalism, is that it's not the case that in advance, in the same way of trying to plan out a society or to try to plan out an economy, that you can verbally say before how you're going to make the price, how you're going to make the profit. All you know is that in a capitalist system, the people who are the most experienced, the most effective in making profits through experience are the individuals who will have more resources. Whereas in a command system, there is no other information conveying device like that. Who is the most effective with resources is as much a question as anything else. World War II, of course, affected events in England as the rest of the world greatly and focused Hayek's attention on the political ramifications of socialism. In his most well-known work, The Road to Serfdom, published during World War II in England, he now argued not only that socialism is unproductive, he argued that socialism is necessarily undemocratic and dictatorial. Unless there's economic freedom, there cannot be political freedom. This is really the crux of the matter, he wrote in The Road to Serfdom. Whoever controls all economic activity controls the means for all our ends. Economic control is not merely control of a sector of human life which can be separated from the rest. The control of the production of wealth is the control of human life itself. And this sounds now commonplace, but at the time there were many who believed that the problems of command collectivist economies wasn't that they owned all of the nation's goods and services, but that they were undemocratic and that somehow there could be a democratic socialism. But Hayek argued profoundly that there can be no political liberty without economic liberty. The Road to Serfdom was a great success, and Hayek made a lecture tour to the United States in the spring of 1945, just as World War II was ending. He visited the University of Chicago, and later, between 1950 and 1962, he was on the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago, and he came in mind with such figures as Milton Friedman, George Stigler, both future Nobel laureates at the University of Chicago. It's interesting to consider the relationship between Friedman and Hayek. They're often considered to be the two greatest philosophers or economists of a free market order during the 20th century. And they were not as close, not quite as close personally and intellectually as is sometimes thought. In terms of their technical economics, while they were both free marketeers, they had substantially different ideas of how money works in the economy. And I must admit that my own presentation is much closer to Milton Friedman's than it is to Friedrich Hayek's in terms of how money in the economy works. I believe that Professor Baird will mention a thing or two about that. Having fortunately seen his comments before, I'm covering myself at this time. So watch for that. However, in terms of notwithstanding their technical disagreements, they both agreed strongly that a free market is the best system. And I think Hayek was much more of a philosopher, someone who put forward broad general ideas, whereas Friedman is much more of an economist, someone who has a more grounded empirical approach. Another great mind with whom Hayek was in contact during these years was the philosopher Karl Popper, like Hayek from Vienna, and also like Hayek, who wound up teaching at the London School of Economics. The great work of Hayek's Chicago period was the Constitution of Liberty. Here he attempted to expand some of the ideas of the division of knowledge that he had developed in economic theory and apply them to all of societal life. In the area of economics, Hayek argued that because knowledge is divided, societies should be able to accommodate divided knowledge in their economic systems, and that economic systems that do not accommodate divided knowledge are necessarily going to be unproductive economic systems. Hayek now attempted to take this idea of the division of knowledge and apply it to all of human life. And his idea was that liberty, and this was his great concept, all his later works, his two great later works, The Constitution of Liberty and Law, Legislation, and Liberty, particularly in the second, The Constitution of Liberty, Law, Legislation, and Liberty, draw attention in their titles to the idea that there is a connection, an intrinsic connection between law and a society and liberty. There cannot be a free society unless people know what the rules in a society are and are able to interact with one another in a way that they can foresee what the consequences of their actions will be. I believe that liberty is the supremacy of law. To some, this may sound a very distinct conception of liberty, because liberty during the 20th century was more often considered to be either the absence of law, constraints, or a certain material standard of liberty, of living. How can liberty be the supremacy of law? Following from his work in the division of knowledge, Hayek postulated that it is law, rules, that allow people to interact more or less effectively. The better or worse laws or rules in a society are, the more or less effectively individuals will interact. The rules that Hayek saw as crucial to a materially productive society are the rules that sustain and create a free market. Private property, contract, profit, freely fluctuating prices, a stable currency, limited government intrusion in and involvement with individuals' lives. Hayek had two great works in him after the Constitution of Liberty was published in 1960. In 1962, he and his second wife moved back to Europe, to Freiburg, and then West Germany. Primarily here, Hayek wrote Law, Legislation, and Liberty, which because of illness was not published until the 1970s. In Law, Legislation, and Liberty, Hayek explored further the relationship between liberty and law. Particularly in its crucial first volume, Rules and Order, he developed the insights that had guided him throughout his earlier career. He expanded the idea of law to not just the legal statutes of a society, but its customs and morals. Hayek was appalled by the protests and revolts among the young during the 1960s. He feared that socialism and in idea and practice would triumph over the free market, particularly as inflation ignited throughout the Western world during the late 1960s and early 70s, as the American position in the world diminished, and as the influence of the Soviet Union expanded. He feared that the prospects for freedom were as imperiled as they had been at any time since World War II. In 1974, most unexpectedly, he was co-recipient of the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences with Swedish socialist Gunnar Myrdal. when Friedman wrote his congratulatory note to Hayek after receiving the Nobel, he said that dear Fritz, I regret that it's taken this long for the Swedes to award you the Nobel, and even then they went only half the way. But he was nonetheless happy that Hayek had received the award. A Nobel Prize in Economics had only been instituted in 1969. Hayek was the first free market economist to receive the reward, and this was the great rejuvenating event for him. It was said at the time that the Swedes really wanted to give the award just to Gunnar Myrdal, but they felt they would be subjected to criticism for giving the award to someone so far on the left, so they joined Hayek with Myrdal, right with left, to be able to create more balance in the presentation of the award. As a result of receiving the Nobel Prize in Economics, Hayek became not merely the best-selling author of a popular work three decades before, but the first free market economist to win a Nobel. As a result of the greater prominence that the Nobel Prize garnered him, he was once again referred to in the popular press, particularly in England. Hayek's greatest later renown was in England, particularly during the 1980s. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher adopted him as her leading philosophical inspirer, and the renown of Hayek in Great Britain is as high as it is in the United States. It's much higher in England than it is here. During the late 1970s and all through the 80s, and Hayek was always a fundamentally British individual in the sense that he lived there for 20 years, his children were raised there and still reside there. He identified most with many English ideas. He was really part of the great stream of English classical liberalism and political philosophy, or political economy, perhaps, is distinct from technical economics. During the late 1970s and through the 1980s, particularly during the time of the Thatcher government in Great Britain and the Reagan administration in the United States, the idea began to emerge that Hayek was not just a great political thinker for a point in time, but a great political thinker for all time. His contributions in the area of the division of knowledge, of the essential role of prices, profits, private property, and contract to a market order, and of the relationship among liberty, law, customs, and morals, began to be recognized as permanent contributions to Western political order and thought. He had been right about Keynes and the welfare state all along, and now with the decline of communism and socialism throughout the world during the 1980s, he came to be recognized as the great anti-socialist, the thinker who enunciated the contours of a new free market order in the same way that Marx philosophically enunciated the idea of a communist system during the 19th century. Hayek's final work was The Fatal Conceit. In 1978, he conceived the idea of organizing a debate on the question, was socialism a mistake? As earlier and elsewhere during his career, Hayek attempted to move a question from the realm of ethics to that of facts. He sought to organize teams on both sides of the proposed debate topic for a great public discussion in Paris. This proposed debate did not come off. However, Hayek wrote a book that was originally intended to be a challenge to debate, The Fatal Conceit, subtitled The Errors of Socialism, in which he attempted to bring his life's work to a conclusion. The insight that he originally developed through the socialist calculation debate, that knowledge is divided and that prices and profits guide production, he now attempted to apply to societies as wholes and their entire complexes of rules, laws, customs, morals, and manners. Now, Hayek argued, there is essentially a Darwinian struggle among different societies and their laws, their rules, broadly understood, and that societies that have the most materially productive rules will be the societies that prevail in the end. After several years of illness, Hayek died in March 1992, less than 2 months shy of his 93rd birthday. Father Johann Schasching said in his homily that Hayek was one looking for solutions to the great problems of mankind. He tried to find an answer. He was himself convinced that his answers were merely a piece within a larger mosaic. Though ill, Hayek was well aware that the Berlin Wall fell and that communism and the Soviet Union collapsed. These events have seemed to justify his life's purpose and message. Within the field of human society, there can be no freedom unless individuals possess substantial liberty to live their lives, including their material lives, substantially as they wish. As Hayek concluded The Road to Serfdom almost a half century before his demise, a policy of freedom for the individual is the only truly progressive policy. The idea that individuals may be made to be better than they are through compulsion is false. As Hayek said so well in the Constitution of Liberty, liberty is an opportunity for doing good. We praise or blame only when a person has the opportunity to choose. Near the end of The Road to Serfdom, he said along this same line on the proper field of morals, individual conduct, that issues in this field have become so confused that it is necessary to go back to fundamentals. What our generation is in danger of forgetting is not only that morals are of necessity a phenomenon of individual conduct, but that they can exist only in the sphere in which the individual is free to decide for himself. The members of a society who in all respects are made to do the good thing have not title to praise. In order to be moral, individuals should have the opportunity to choose the right thing to do. Economist and political philosopher though he was, Hayek was also ultimately a moralist. His foundational assumptions included that if individuals are given freedom, they will choose to do the right things, and that collectivist coercion steals from human what makes us human, free will. Since the talk this night was announced as Friedrich Hayek and the Future of Freedom, I'd like to conclude with some thoughts that are partly extrapolation on Hayek's view of freedom in the circumstances of the present political and economic or societal situation in the United States. Hayek was more a philosopher and philosophical economist than a practical policy advisor, and it is the case that his practical policy suggestions have often been criticized by individuals who thought that they have conceded too much to welfare state liberalism, that although he philosophically enunciated ideas for freedom, nonetheless he would, in his practical advice, allow a reasonable role for government, and to some extent that may be a product of the times in which he wrote, given that governmental ideas were so prominent during the idea of larger government was so prominent during the 20th century, it was perhaps inevitable that his thought would be tainted in that way. Following a conversation with David Thoreau, I'd like to offer these thoughts on Hayek. Hayek concluded the postscript of the Constitution of Liberty with an essay titled, Why I Am Not a Conservative, and it is undoubtedly the case that Hayek was not a conservative in the European sense of one who favored strong governmental control. Indeed, he noted in Why I Am Not a Conservative that both traditional European conservatives and socialists had more in common with each other than either shares with the classical liberal position of freedom. At the same time, as earlier mentioned, Hayek was appalled by the student riots and protests of the 1960s and of the general counter-cultural movement during this time, though he did not believe that government should prescribe or proscribe certain ethics. However, he was greatly disappointed by the change in societal ethics during the 1960s and 70s, and in some of his last essays, he spoke of the importance of the family to capitalist societies. I believe that there is a fundamental alliance between Hayekian liberalism and social conservatism, and this would be based on the idea that if people are given freedom, they will choose conservative social values. The problem with government in our time is that it encourages values that are antithetical to enabling strong communities based on traditional values and morals to emerge. The essence of the Hayekian position is that people should, in freedom, have the opportunity to lead the lives and choose the communities in which they desire to live. One Hayekian scholar, Jeremy Shimer, has written of optimal Hayekian society as consisting of competing communities that would have variegated lifestyles and societal patterns. Individuals would then have the choice to live in the communities which they desired. This is an attractive ideal. The idea of societal diversity is, from a Hayekian perspective, not adequately understood. Diversity is not just in societies and institutions, but of societies and institutions. A recent example will provide a case in point. There's an entity called WASC, which is the Western Association of Schools and Colleges, through which all colleges and institutions have to be accredited. And there were questions regarding diversity issues at a small private college, Thomas Aquinas College, as to whether they would be accredited by WASC as a result of the moral and ethical principles which they wanted their students and faculty to uphold. And it's very important for students to be accredited, as colleges to be accredited, because if colleges aren't accredited, then students aren't able to receive guaranteed student loans and that sort of thing, so it's a real practical issue. And I think that the Hayekian idea of diversity is not that every single university in the United States is going to be a carbon copy of each other. There can be diversity of institutions as well as diversity in institutions. And the problem in our society today is that we focus almost exclusively on diversity in institutions and not diversity of institutions. There's another idea of diversity, and I think that Hayek's idea is entirely congruent with that other idea. Let's see here. I think that Hayek's position would not be that state-sanctioned imposition of universal policy codes of any sort are the appropriate way to go. Rather, there should be the greatest diversification and diversity of societies and institutions possible. This example, moreover, has broader societal implications. Over 100 years ago, John Stuart Mill wrote in On Liberty of the increasing tendency of people to read the same things, speak the same things, hear the same things, and suggested that liberty of thought and expression is the essence of a genuinely free and libertarian society. American society today is in many respects much the same as Mill described it over 100 years ago, as politically correct speech codes on college campuses attest. There are great limits on what can be expressed and thought in American society today. As in Mill's time, individuals with views contrary to those sanctioned by the majority, or perhaps even merely an empowered elite minority, may express their views only using extreme care. The idea of reducing the power of government all around is consistent with the practice of diverse communities, within themselves and among themselves, and of genuinely free intellectual inquiry and thought. One of the things that most interested me in researching Friedrich Hayek, a biography, were lecture notes of Hayek that he gave while he was on the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago, where he emphasized the absolute importance and centrality of freedom of thought, expression, and discussion to a free and libertarian society. From a practical perspective, Hayek's ideas point in the direction of local governance rather than centralized governments, and of private and voluntary provision of social services and activities than of state-mandated ones. In the same way that government cannot centrally manage provision of a nation's welfare services, at least not in the same way that government cannot centrally manage a nation's economy, neither may government be able centrally to manage provision of a nation's welfare services, at least optimally, which social policy during recent decades seems to suggest. The Hayekian idea of community is in many ways similar to that of a socially conservative one, of free and moral individuals who choose and create the communities in which they live. Too often, government is a hindrance toward the creation of these sorts of communities, as government attempts to manage all of a nation's economy were. Perhaps the next step in the Hayekian public policy program should be to turn the insights that he developed in his critique of socialism, that government attempts to manage all of a nation's economy are invariably inefficient, to turn this insight to the idea that government attempts to manage all of a nation's moral and ethical practices are equally inefficient. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan.